You're listening to KSCO Santa Cruz, Salinas, Monterey, and San Jose, and 104 FM. This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for joining me. Animals are the topic this week. We discuss horses with Dr. Alan J. Hamilton. Dr. Alan J. Hamilton is a neurosurgeon and a professor at the University of Arizona. He's a consultant to Grey's Anatomy, the TV show, not the book. And he's a horseman, and he has written many books and scholarly articles, but his latest book is Lead with Your Heart, Lessons from a Life with Horses, Finding Wholeness and Harmony at the End of a Lead Rope. If you ride horses, then this book is a must, and if you have friends who ride, then you can thank me later for solving your Christmas gift problems. Dr. Alan J. Hamilton, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Well, thank you so much for having me, Gary.
I found your book to be incredibly fascinating, and I want to ask you about some of the points you make in this great little book. Horses do not use their potential as pleasure horses.
Oh, I think in a way, what I meant there is you have to sort of divide the book up. It's about 112 lessons, and it's based on my work as a trainer with horses over the last 30 years, but the lessons, to some extent, drawn from the horse world and also relate to the human world. In that particular instance, what I was talking about is that most people get way more horse than they'll ever need. And that's kind of a weakness. You know, we tend to think that the problem's with the horse, but in point of fact, what really holds horses back is us. When you really concentrate and work hard on training horses, what you find is when you bump up against a limitation in the horse, it's really your limitation that you have to confront. And that's what makes horses such great teachers, but it's also what makes training them such a journey for the people who are doing it.
Well, now, in your book, there's a little biography of you, and I did some research on the web, and I know you also have German Shepherd dogs, and you also have cattle. Can you talk a little bit, and you're a neurosurgeon, so you know something about brains, I'm assuming.
Yep, just a little.
So could you talk a little bit about the intelligence of the animals that you work with, humans, cattle, dogs, horses?
Well, let me focus more on horses and dogs, because those are domestic animals that a lot of people have familiarity with. They're very different. We're predators. Our eyes are in the front. We think in a certain fashion. So it's very easy for us intuitively connect with dogs. So if I'm training a German Shepherd, I can do something like I can go, here, boy, that's it. Come here, that's it. Come around on you. Oh, that's good. Okay, so I get him all pumped up like that because I understand that. You know, I'm a predator, and you can go, oh, that's a great job. You did a great job on that presentation. You know, whatever, okay? So predators always are kind of after something. That's what motivates us. We're very goal-driven in a way. Horses, on the other hand, they're prey animals. Okay, so they're not after something so much as they're looking for tranquility, a release from pressure. So to put that into perspective, just imagine for a moment, Gary, a thoroughbred horse race versus a greyhound dog race. Okay, in the thoroughbred horse race, you have the horse in a claustrophobic gait. You suddenly release the horse, and then they're trying to outrun each other as if they're trying to escape a predator, and in fact they're sort of getting their rear ends whacked by the jockeys as they do it. Then they get over the finish line and they finally go, oh good, that's over. Okay, now that's not to say you don't have thoroughbreds that have heart. You do. But what you're really talking about with heart is this desire to compete to get away to the front of the herd.
And they want to be in front because they want to be the last one eaten by the lion or whatever.
Exactly. Saber-toothed tigers after you, you don't want to be at the back of the pack. You want to be at the front. Now, greyhounds are different. When you open that door, they're looking around. They have to see a mechanical rabbit. They have to see something to chase, to go after, in order to motivate them to run, and they're trying to outrun each other to get the object of desire, so to speak. So it's a very different mindset, and the brains work very differently in those animals. So For example, dogs, as you know, are very verbal. You know, you can use a lot of commands. In fact, I have a border collie. She probably understands over 100 different commands. Now, horses, they're not verbal at all. In fact, horse hears whoa and go sound very similar to them. They're much more interested in how do you shape your body and the position that you hold yourself in and your gestures and the energy that's sort of contained within your body. How do you shape that to support them in a partnership, to get them to move the way you're trying to get them to move? So they're very nonverbal. And in a way, what their reward is you slightly increase the pressure and energy coming from your body, and when they move in the right way, you release that energy, and they go, oh, that was it. That was where the energy got more quiet. That's what I'm looking for. And so it's a very different system of rewards. It's a very different system of learning, but there's a lot that we can have insight to by working with prey animals, because it is such a different way of looking at the world.
Well, would you say that horses are as intelligent as dogs? They just relate on a different level?
You know, I think that's a good question. A lot of people will say dogs are smarter. And I think they're smarter because we tend to think of them in predator terms, like, oh, well, if they know 80 words, that's better than, you know, if they know only 20. Prey animals are very, very intelligent. They're just not an intelligence that's the same as predatory intelligence. So let me give you a quick example, okay? There was an experiment. It was actually done here at the University of Arizona. And they showed horses 20 different patterns. And in the 20 different patterns, they had to choose between a pair. And when they started to learn the right pair, they got a pellet of food. And they taught it to the horses, and they taught it to the humans. Then they came back a year later, and they tested the horses and the humans. Humans, 50-50 chance they were going to get it right. They were choosing between two patterns. It was complete random luck. Horses, 95% accurate. So you say to yourself,
they never forget a pellet.
They never forget, because as a predator, if I miss an antelope, okay, in my hunting, I go, well, okay, next antelope, I'll get it right. But if you're the prey animal, you don't get the other chance. You go, if I waited, hesitated a second too long, I'm lunch. I never got my genes into the gene pool. So horses, prey animals, you know, like, for example, an elephant, we always say an elephant never forgets. Well, prey animals have to have great memories. They have to know where there was food, where's the water hole. The last time I saw grass bent over like that, a tiger jumped out. So they remember everything because their lives depend on, I can't make that mistake more than once.
You were talking in your book about how your dog, or a dog, would chase a ball all day long. You could throw the ball 27,000 times and the dog would chase it 27,000 times. But the horse, after four repetitions of something that you're trying to teach him, would be done after four times.
Yep. I always say with horses when I'm training, you know, humans with their horses, I would go more than four is a bore. Now, dogs, you know, I use the example playing fetch. You know, you can just play fetch all day long and the dog will just keep going after the ball because it's always got something to chase. But the horse, it's different. They're going, look, we did this before. I'm looking for some peace and tranquility. We've already done this. Let's stop. So the way to get a horse to really be motivated is to change the tasks up. And you can come back to the task, but over and over and over again, the horse just begins to shut down because the sheer repetition has no real incentive for them. It's they're looking for, did I achieve the release? And they go, okay, I did it. I'm already done. You know, there's nothing new here. So it's a very different perspective. And again, it comes from the prey animal's view of life versus the predator animal's view of life.
Well, dogs and children and me, we like it when somebody praises us and tell us, you know, we did a good job. I like it when you say, that's a good question, Gary. So what about my horse? I mean, I praise my horse, and I tell her she's a good girl, and I pat her. Does she care that I'm telling her this?
Yes, very much. Now, there's a big...
She never wags her tail.
She never wag. If they wag their tail, horses are different. When they start wrenching their tail around, it means they're anxious and upset. It's very different. They have different ways of moving their tail when they're just swatting flies versus you've got me anxious. So the thing that happens with horses is they're looking for a partnership. They're looking to feel as, hey, when I'm with you, it's peaceful. Things are moving in a predictable, peaceful, tranquil fashion, and your energy elevates me, and then I accomplish what you want, and your energy releases me. So in a lot of ways, horses are just as anxious to get affection as we are, but for different reasons. We're sort of anxious to get affection because we're going, you know, like panting dogs, did I get it? Did I get it? Did I get it right? The horse is looking for affection because the horse is saying, is this peaceful? Is this where we're supposed to be? Are you my partner? It's sort of that physical reassurance to the horse. And my mantra is pause, pet, breathe. People don't stop enough to acknowledge the horse's accomplishment or other human beings' accomplishment. When I talk about lessons that you should take from horses to life, one of them is stop and acknowledge that people have done things for you, that people have accomplished things. There's this wonderful saying from a French cavalry officer named Badin who said, ask for a lot, settle for less, and reward frequently. there are these lessons where you learn with the horse teaches you, take a moment to reward the horse and tell the horse it was a job well done and thank you for doing that for me. And then the horse begins to say, okay, this guy's a fair guy to work with. And he shows his appreciation and his release of me every time I accomplish what he's trying to do.
We're talking with Dr. Alan J. Hamilton. He's a neurosurgeon. He's a consultant to the TV show Grey's Anatomy. And he knows everything about horses. His new book is called Lead with Your Heart. Or Lead with Your Heart, it could be. I'm not sure.
Lead.
You talked a little bit about the eyes being in front. On my head, they're in front, and on your head, and on my dog's head. But on the horse, they're on the side. And so I want you to tell us a little bit about what it's like to be a horse, what goes on inside the horse's head. Sometimes I think, God, if I could just be in her head for 10 seconds, I would know so much. What's it like to be in a head of a horse?
Well, I agree with you. If you can get in their head, you know that expression, if you want to be different, you have to see different. So the idea that I can use that horse, and I really think of them as sort of like Zen masters. You know, they've kind of like, you go up to the round pen and they go, so you think you're ready, grasshopper? You know, come, we shall see. You know, so part of the horse's orientation is they're taking in a vast amount of visual information with their eyes on both sides of the head. So they're seeing almost 160 degrees. So they have a small blind spot in the front and a blind spot in the back, about 20 degrees going over their tail. Okay? So they have this massive awareness of the world around them, which they have to have as prey animals. But they also have an energetic awareness that extends hundreds of yards out. So, for example, I can go out into a pasture full of horses, and I can say, I want the sorrel horse or I want the paint horse over there. And as soon as I pick that horse out in my mind, that horse will pick up their head, but the other horses won't. And you say to yourself, why? And it says that horse has suddenly felt the focus of your energy on him, and he's going, what's that focus of energy on me for?
I think I just want to interject that, well, I think you're crazy, Dr. Hamilton.
Well, if you think about it, think about the human equivalent. You're at a cocktail party, right?
Mm-hmm.
And suddenly you feel like, you go, man, you turn around, somebody's staring at me, and lo and behold, they're staring at you. So you say to yourself, what did you feel that made you turn around? What is it that says to you when somebody keeps staring at you intently, we break our vision away? You know, if you see somebody on the subway or the bus and they just keep staring at you fixed fashion, you stop. You want to break it off because you feel the energy of that stare.
That's primate threat behavior, right?
Exactly. So the horse feels that fixed gaze on it. And you go out and do the experiment yourself. I've done it hundreds of times, that I'll say, go pick any horse you want. Just pick them. And as soon as you start to pick him and walk, boy, that horse will pick his head up because he feels your intention on him.
Hmm.
He feels like, okay, you're staring fixedly at me and nobody else.
Now, I've heard that horses can also, in addition to seeing and smelling and hearing, their hooves tell them a lot.
The vibration, absolutely. The vibration in their hooves tell them a lot. But we also forget they have enormous visual capability. So, for example, their night vision is as good as what we have with night goggles. They have these huge retinas that take in tremendous amounts of light. Their sense of smell is exquisite. You know, their sense of feel in their feet is also exquisite. You know, I've had a horse lead me down in an absolute whiteout, a snowstorm, where I could not figure out where to go. And I just had the signal of just let go. And I kind of knotted the reins up and put them on my horse's neck and held on to the horn. And he picked his way, the horn of the saddle, he picked his way through those rocks and down the mountainside. And about an hour later, I heard clump, clump, clump. And I recognized that his hoofs were on this wooden bridge that led to the parking lot. And we were all the way down off the mountain. But it was an amazing feat of perception, of sensory ability, that, you know, I have no idea how he did it.
And further evidence that you're crazy.
Well, I mean, I'm crazy about horses, but I think the lessons I've learned from them are stupendous.
Yeah.
And I mean, I've applied them in my life. I've taught them to corporate leaders. I teach a course, negotiating skills for lawyers and business people, businessmen.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because you say to yourself, well, how does that apply? And I go, well, if you have to negotiate with a 1,200-pound partner, believe me, you begin to understand negotiation signals. You know, you get to understand, hey, this is a deal-breaker for my 1,200-pound partner. I'm going to pay attention to that.
Well, I'm a middle school teacher, and I've always thought of my experience with horses as being very useful as a classroom management tool. I mean, if you want to put a 1,250-pound animal in a trailer and they don't want to go.
Yes.
Then they're not going to go.
Right.
And if you're leading 35, 12-year-olds somewhere and they don't want to go, then they're not going to go unless you lead them with confidence and lead with your heart, my friend Dr. Hamilton says.
Yeah.
Yeah. Talk a little bit about what you were... I was fascinated by the lead rope. You were saying that mm-hmm. people pull too hard on the lead rope. You elaborate, if you would.
So, you know, it's sort of our natural inclination. When we have a horse on the end of a lead rope, we start to pull on it. We start to say, hey, come this way. And, you know, you have to remember the zen of it. Yes, you have the horse on the end of the rope, but the horse has you on the end of the rope. You know, and you know, if you start to create, which we do as predators, lines of what I call lines of resistance, where, you know, we start to pull, the horse pulls, we pull a little bit more, the horse pulls a little bit more. You have to say to yourself, wait a minute, I got a 1,200-pound creature on the end of this. There's no way I can win that proposition if I push it to its natural, logical end. So you say to yourself, well, what's my alternative? And the alternative is get that horse to flow with you, because they like to move in curves. So use your body and use your energy to get that horse to move of his own volition and to follow you. And then you go, then you just are leading the horse with your body and not really, and I teach this to students all the time, don't use the lead rope. Use your body and pull the horse towards you, you know? You know, and I tell people, think if you came on a lost child at the mall, okay, you wouldn't go to the child, hey, come here. You'd get down and you'd be going, sweetie, what's the matter? Where's your parents? Where's mommy? Where's daddy? Are you lost? You're down there pulling them towards you, and that's the feeling that you want when you're pulling on the horse, is that idea. So why is that important? Because as predators, we immediately think of resistance means more energy. Resistance means more strength. Might is right. And the horse is going, no, there's an alternative. We can deal with a curve of compromise. We can deal with the idea that we try and flow together as partners. And it's much more productive. And believe me, at work, I'm sometimes sitting with my staff and going, am I creating a line of resistance or am I creating a curve of compromise here?
I want to talk a little bit about behaviors that horse owners struggle with. You address some of these in your book.
Okay.
So let's say my horse cribs, but she only cribs at every opportunity that she has for cribbing.
Mm-hmm.
When you tie her, she immediately goes, oh boy, I get to crib at this thing.
Mm-hmm.
And cribbing, for those of you who are unaware, is when the horse grabs a hold of a bar or a stick or whatever and sort of sucks in some air. And it's not good for the horse to crib. And how do you stop them from cribbing?
Okay, so usually, I don't want to get too much into the real horse mechanics of it, but very often horses are cribbing. In large part, it's kind of repetitive air swallowing, and they grab onto a bar and they yank on it with their teeth at the same time they gulp air. So if you think about these repetitive kind of behaviors, they're very often have a component of compulsion about them. And for me, the absolute best way I know to get a horse to stop cribbing is give them something else to do. You know, so very often the horses that are cribbing are not the horses that are out playing in big, wide-open pastures. They're the horses that are standing stock still in a stall or a small enclosure, and they have nothing. They're just standing there. So then they start saying, well, you know, very often they're just going to try and amuse themselves. And there's kind of almost a aspect that reminds me a little bit of autism about it, this repetitive, compulsive behavior, rhythmic, compulsive behavior. So, you know, the fastest way in the world to get a horse to stop cribbing is give them an interesting life so they don't stand there. So very often I'll say to people, put a whole bunch of stuff in their stall that they can play with and amuse themselves with. But the other thing is try and get them to play more and get them out more and socializing more. It's rare that horses will do that when they're with other horses.
Right, right. It's just when she's in her stall or tied at the
mm-hmm.
rail. Right.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's very interesting. Just, you know, tell us a little bit about how you got started with horses.
Well, I grew up early in life. Unfortunately, I grew up in a house with domestic violence, and my mom took my brother and I and left, and my grandfather raised me, and my grandfather was a former cavalry officer and a very accomplished equestrian. So that was a combination of sort of the father figure and hero in my life had this profound interest. And so I think part of it probably was genetic and part of it was just acquired. But I just grew to absolutely love horses and became a, you know, camp counselor, riding counselor. And then I just kept up with it, and it's been, you know, my avocation, you know, my day job is being a brain surgeon, but that's kind of all left brain and, you know, stainless steel and precision and MRI scans and all of that. And this opportunity to go train horses is all intuitive. It's all emotional. It's all right brain stuff. So it kind of keeps me balanced.
Well, it's a wonderful book. It's called Lead With Your Heart, Lessons from a Life with Horses. The author, Alan J. Hamilton. He's a professional horseman and an amateur brain surgeon. That's what he does. His hobby is brain surgery. And you're a fine writer, and I recommend this book to everybody on earth. And
well,
thanks.
Thank you, Gary.
Thanks so much for talking to us on From the Bookshelf.
Oh, you bet. Thanks for having me, Gary.
Well, that's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next week. Check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can like us on Facebook, and you can subscribe to the podcast at iTunes. My thanks to Dr. Alan J. Hamilton. His book is called Lead With Your Heart, Lessons from a Life with Horses. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas. I'm Gary Shapiro. We'll see you next time.